Hello, everyone. This is Martin Willis, your host, and we have Linda Zimmerman, who I met out in Phoenix. She's going to be on for both hours. I'm really excited to talk to her, and you will enjoy her. She's a great speaker. And don't forget, we have some T-shirts on our website that nobody likes, but you can order them for, you know, I'm probably going to cut the price. So anyone, just throw me something. I'll send you a T-shirt. How's that? Well, maybe not. Anything. But anyway, I would like to thank everyone for their support. If you haven't subscribed and you want to hear a second hour of the podcast, go to getjoyride.com and /podcastUFO. The link's right on our website. And subscribers pay $1 a month or more to access the full two-hour show. And if you're having any trouble in any way, just email me at martin@podcastufo.com. And every listener, whether you support or not, is very much appreciated. Now, I want to say that we lost Jerry Pippin. He passed away a few days ago, or maybe even yesterday. I'm not sure. Michael Lauk, who used to be the newscaster on the show, was a big fan of Jerry's. And Jerry, you will be missed. I understand he ran a great show. So what's going on with the news this week?
Well, I've got a couple of things. I think that your listeners probably haven't heard of that are a little bit, well, this one's a little bit older news, but I don't think a lot of people know about it. And it really kind of, we got more detail at the UFO Congress, is Thomas Reed and his case. Have you ever had Tom Reed on the show?
I believe he's going to be on next week. And okay. Yeah, he was texting me all this information, all the media that was happening with this.
Yeah, so what happened is the Great Barrington Historical Society and Museum have inducted he and his family's case. Now, they believe they've been having abduction experiences since 1966. And so one of the sightings, there was a flap of sightings that was related to his case, and that was really popular, picked up by the local radio station. The case was even investigated by Blue Book and brought up in a list of many cases in a kind of back room meeting at the UN. And so it's gotten some attention. And because all of that, some of the people at the Historical Society felt that the case was so compelling that they believe it to be real. And they've decided to inducted into their historical society, and they've been out, especially the director of the historical society, saying, I believe this case is real. Tom Reed has had a polygraph test. I've heard his story and his family story, and I think this is a real historical event, and that's why we have inducted him. Now, she does admit that not the entire board agreed. It was not unanimous. Three people were strongly opposed to putting this case in there, but that the rest of them decided to go for it, probably with some help with her enthusiasm. So yeah, the director, Debbie Opperman, made this happen. So it's kind of exciting, and it is pretty unique sort of thing. And of course, as you can imagine, Tom Reed has been very excited about it, and he talked about it when he did a presentation at the Congress.
Right. He was one of the people that was delayed a day. He was going to be live on the show for the listeners that caught that. I was telling everyone when I was going to be in Phoenix that he was going to be on the show as one of the people on the live show, and he was detained from weather issues.
Yeah, it was not the government that detained him. It was Mother Nature.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, and unfortunately, his flight was canceled, and he couldn't get another one for 2 days. So that postponed his talk till Friday morning. He had to come in. He was a real trooper. He came in like at 2 o'clock in the morning, had some drinks because Richard Dolan was out, he said, having some drinks. So he had some drinks with Dolan and then went to bed. And he was up to be the first speaker the next morning. So he was a real trooper, and he did a great job. And that story, you can, with some pictures of him doing his talk, you can read at openminds.tv, of course.
Now, did he get some selfies of, did Richard get some selfies with him?
With Thomas Reed?
Oh, yeah.
Not that I know of.
Or was it just more of pictures of himself? Probably.
There are people who have posted pictures of him with others.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
But I don't know if he's posted any with
I don't
him
think so. Yes, he did with Bob Lazar. An illegal picture.
Oh, yeah, an illegal backstage picture.
Yeah. So what else is happening?
So another one that comes from the UFO Congress. I've been focusing on writing about, you know, stories that came out of the Congress. And this one's really cool because at the Congress, John Burroughs, one of the Rendlesham Forest witnesses, and his lawyer, Pat Fresconia, who you've had on the show, I believe, they were at the conference and they released a press release. And essentially, as we've talked about, they have been pursuing, you know, getting medical disability for John Burroughs for the UFO event. He believes he has health issues that stem from that. Well, they finally came back with the final ruling, and they did give him his benefits. They kept his medical records classified, according to Burroughs and Fresconia. However, they did give him his benefits. So
good for him.
Yeah, they released a press release saying this, and the title of the press release was U.S. Government's De Facto Acknowledgement of the Existence of UFOs. So they're essentially saying because the government acknowledged he got hurt in the line of duty, they are thus acknowledging that it was a UFO that had this effect on him, and so by de facto, they are acknowledging that UFOs exist. So that's what they're saying. So kind of interesting. And, of course, it was McCain's office, Senator John McCain's office, they worked with to get these files released and get him his disability. So we've covered this. Linda Moulton Howe has covered this. I know a few others. Billy Cox, I know, wrote about it. However, it finally did break the mainstream yesterday as well, where the Daily Mirror in the UK covered this. I've sent my story around to various media, so I hope other media cover this as well. But, yeah, I think it's a very interesting story, especially given that, you know, we've talked about this, where in this Condyne report from the UK Defense Intelligence, they speculated that these guys might have been affected by what they called UAP, another term for UFO radiation. So I think it's a really interesting case that has some legs.
I do too. One of my, I don't want to say favorite cases, but I think one of the most profound cases of them all out there is, I personally think Rendlesham Forest ranks about second.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Roswell, I know people get tired of hearing the word Roswell, but that case to me is probably the top mm-hmm. documented case. I feel like you may be casting some type of judgment. Am I feeling that?
No, I'm thinking about it. I think I would probably agree just because there's been so many witnesses to Roswell. Of course, Nick Pope, I think, would disagree. But, of course, he's a British gentleman. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think most people would agree with you. It's a very important case.
It is. So what's the last one?
The last one is a MUFON story. This is kind of interesting. Some interesting photographs submitted by a witness in Philadelphia. So the other day, February 26th, he says at 7:38 p.m., he was driving and he saw all of these lights and they were moving around strangely. Swirling is a term that he used. And at first he thought there were reflections from inside his car. And then he realized after a while that they weren't. So he got out of his car, took some pictures and video, and submitted those. And it is interesting. I mean, if I didn't know better, I would say, well, it could be balloons or Chinese lanterns, which it possibly could be just given the pictures. But if he's correct and they were swirling and moving around in the manner he says they were, they're pretty odd in that the formations fairly different from one picture to the next. He did not submit the video because he said it was too poor. He just really couldn't get much on the video. But the pictures are pretty compelling. So everybody should take a look and see what they think.
Excellent. So that will be through our show notes on podcastufo.com, and you'll be able to see that. And also, getting back to Jerry Pippin, I just wanted to say that we will have a link on our show notes as well that will bring you to his website where you can actually leave a condolence note on that for his family.
Yeah, well, he'll be missed. I've known him for years, and he was a great guy, a very nice guy. A lot of fun to see him. You would usually see him in Roswell, so I'm definitely going to miss him.
Yeah, yeah, I heard nothing but good about him. Well, all right, Alejandro, thanks a lot, and we'll be talking to you next week.
All right, talk to you next week, buddy.
All right, so hang in for the music break, and we'll be right back with Linda Zimmerman. It was a pleasure meeting you, Linda, out in Phoenix, and you were on our podcast just for a couple of minutes, and I said I'd have you on, and here you are. So,
yeah, it was great. I had a wonderful time out in Arizona there. They really do an incredible job with that whole conference. It for us, it ran very smoothly, I'm sure. I'm sure not so much for them. I'm sure they encounter a lot of problems, but they really pull it off and throw a fantastic event.
I thought so, too. And I've been involved in a lot of events over the years, different types of events, but it's not easy at all. And one little thing, you know, one little thing changes. Like, for instance, Tom Reed, his flight canceled, and it kind of puts a chink in the armor, and you have to figure out what to do. And luckily, you came around and took his spot. And it all seemed to work out.
Yeah.
Good thing you were ready.
Well, it was funny because we were delayed getting in on Tuesday. And when we finally get there, the first thing, you know, person I see is Alejandro, who says, "Can you fill in first thing in the morning?" I'm like a little shell shocked, but I said, "Sure, what the heck? If I'm not ready then, I wasn't going to be ready in another day." So yeah. I was happy to fill in. It worked out perfectly.
Now, this first hour, we're going to talk – well, first of all, we're going to be talking about your book, which is called UFOs Over Hudson Valley. Do I have that right?
Hudson Valley UFOs, and the first one was In the Night Sky, which is also about Hudson Valley UFOs.
I'm sorry I messed that up. This is live radio.
No problem.
But anyway, the second hour, we're going to be focusing a little bit more on the Triangle UFOs and also Pine Bush.
Right.
Right. So let's talk about your book. And before we do that, though, I would like to find out, it's always an interesting story how people have a fascination, how they get started in the topic of UFOs. So I'm going to ask you, how did that happen with you?
Well, I grew up in the Hudson Valley, and just about everyone I know had sightings. And I had two that were very interesting that I certainly couldn't explain, and I actually began my career as a research scientist for a medical diagnostics company. I had the desire to write, so I started writing about science and history and some paranormal things, and the writing about UFOs really only occurred a few years ago when I would give a lecture somewhere in the Hudson Valley, and people would just start telling me their UFO stories. And I had no idea how widespread this phenomenon really was. So that's what it came to me. It wasn't anything I had, you know, sat down one day and said, "I think I'll start researching this."
Okay, well, let's, before we move on and talk about the gist of this whole thing, can you explain to us you said you had two sightings, and can you tell us about them?
Sure. The I'll start with the second one first. It's easier. The Hudson Valley Boomerang, the triangle-shaped or V-shaped craft. Friend and I went out to a friend's house one night. We were driving back in the town of Washingtonville, and she said, "What are those lights?" And I looked over, and perfect V-shape, round, soft white lights. And I describe them as soft because it's unlike any kind of other aircraft light I have ever seen. Absolutely silent, smooth, gliding motion of this craft, and it was enormous, and it just slowly moved across the sky and out of sight.
Wow, so that's a pretty good one.
Yeah, that was pretty good one. The first one was better. I was in college in the late 70s, and a friend called and said, "Linda, get outside right now. Something just passed over her house and was headed in the direction of where I was living in the town of Nanuet." So I was studying for an organic chemistry test, I recalled. I had my fuzzy red bathrobe on, and I just ran right out the door. And sure enough, there were three lights again, soft, whitish yellow, flying in, you know, a little V shape, just the three of them. Again, silent, gliding. My boyfriend and his friend were over. We all jumped in the car. I'm still in my bathrobe. And we took off after these lights. And they, after a short distance, they separated. One went east, one went north, one went south. So they were ready to give up. But I had remembered seeing in an old Frank Edwards book, I think it might have been Flying Saucers, Serious Business. He had a picture of a UFO over a local state park. So I said, you know what? Let's just drive up to that park. It was about 20 minutes away. And we're sitting by a lake in the middle of the woods waiting and waiting. I'm about to give up. And all of a sudden, here come the three lights from the east, the north, and the south. They come together. And we thought they were going to collide. They come together in this blinding blue flash, and as one blue object lowers to the top of this nearby mountain, and you could see this pulsating blue light through the trees. Well, at this point, the state trooper shows up and wants to know what a girl in a black bathrobe is doing in a car with two guys. So I realized I was in a precarious situation as it was, and I talking about UFOs wasn't going to be much better, but I briefly described what we saw, and I said, just turn around and look. And he turns around, and he sees this light, this bizarre blue light pulsing, and, I mean, his entire expression changed like he had seen a ghost, and he said, get out of here right away.
Wow.
So we took off. He actually passed us taking off down the road.
That's comforting.
Yes. When state troopers are blowing by you. And it was a good thing he showed up, I guess, because my inclination, bathrobe and all, was to run on into the woods and see what this thing was, which probably wouldn't have been the most the best course of action I could have taken.
Probably would have joined Travis Walton up there or something.
Could have, or running around the woods in the dark just from a safety standpoint isn't too smart either. But, yeah, I'm very curious, but it wasn't ideal circumstances for hiking up there.
Yeah, if you're listening live on the Dark Matter Radio Network, you can jump over to podcastufo.com, and right on the sidebar, there's a chat room. You can join that, just two clicks, and you can ask our guest a question or two or communicate with other people in the chat room. Okay, so that is an amazing sighting. Now, you mentioned that you had read that book, so you did have some type of interest in UFOs, it appears.
Yes, as a kid, I loved UFOs and, watched everything I could on television and read every book I could find. And again, growing up in the Hudson Valley, everybody had sightings. It wasn't an uncommon thing, and it had been, you know, at least the generation before me had been having them. And, you know, my generation was still having them. And then going into the 80s with the triangles, which, you know, we'll be talking about in the second hour. But it wasn't an uncommon thing. So nobody, you know, had a great explanation as to what we were seeing. But we all knew there were strange craft in the sky.
Now, I'd like you to go back and start talking about as far back as you researched and what you found, sort of, you know, moving forward. But had you heard a lot of, I think I've heard of a lot of explanations or debunking of what people were seeing?
Well, the big excuse, official excuse for the triangles at least, were formations of ultralight planes, which is, you know, absurd because they're noisy, it's illegal to fly at night, it's very difficult to stay in formation, so that was ridiculous. But of course, the earlier sightings, the usual, the planet Venus, weather balloons, meteors, things like that, the typical blue book excuses for what everyone was seeing.
Now, I want to ask you before we move on to what to your book and your research and everything. When you had those two sightings, what was the most profound part of what hit you the hardest on what you saw and witnessed?
Well, that's a good question. Nobody's ever asked me that. I'm getting goosebumps now because when, you know, you doubt what you're seeing. I was going to school to be a chemist, and I'm trying to be rational about it. But when those three lights came together as one, there was just nothing I knew in this, you know, in my textbooks that could explain what I was just seeing. Hmm. And that blue glow, I can still vividly see it. You just knew you were seeing something otherworldly. And it was scary. It was exhilarating. It was something like you were part of something special.
Right. Now, did you ever speak to the officer again?
No, I don't know who it was. He might still be driving. I don't know. But if he's out there listening, I would love to hear from him again.
And how about the people that were with you in the car?
I spoke to my boyfriend at the time when I was writing the book, and I wanted to get his recollection of it. And I said, before I tell you my recollection, he described the same exact thing. So I said, okay, we're on the same page. And he said the same thing. He was saying the softness of those lights, the silence of the motion. It just gave you a chill up your spine.
Well, yeah, that's amazing. And the part that when they were silent, that's another part that's what baffled me in my own sighting. I just kept waiting for a noise.
Right. It's like something's wrong here. It's like watching the TV with the sound off. You're like, well, something's not right. I should be hearing this, because it wasn't that far away. And even when the three objects came together, we should have heard something, and there was nothing.
Okay. So let's go back all the way back to the beginning of the research that you did, and, you know, the first sightings that people were talking about, or were they in newspapers? How did you do that research?
I sat down at a microfiche machine and started going through old newspapers and looking for anything that had something to do with aviation or, you know, strange sightings in the sky. And I actually came across a series of articles way back in 1909 that were talking about mysterious airships. And I know in the 1897, there were the mysterious airships in California, Texas, other locations. But this was the first I was hearing about them in the New York area, New England. And they began in the Hudson Valley around July of 1909. Now, these were objects only seen at night, and no planes were flying at night yet at that point. They had lights. They could hover. They could move very quickly. And they were seen for hours at a time. So I did my aviation research and found out we had no aircraft that could do that. And the sightings actually spread to New England. One night it was seen from New York to Boston. Another night, the town of Worcester, Massachusetts, was seeing them for hours. And this continued through at least December of that year.
And what were people speculating since it was so early in the game there? What were they coming up with what they were seeing?
Well, that's the interesting thing. No one was panicking. No one thought they were invaders from Mars. They thought that either the Wright brothers or Thomas Edison had invented some new aircraft that could fly at night. And they were honestly expecting, was saying in the articles that we expect any day now to have this amazing craft revealed. And they waited and they waited and nothing was ever revealed. Critics now say it was mass hysteria. Well, hysterical about what? They thought it was a man-made aircraft. Go ahead.
Well, they weren't flying at night in early aviation.
No one had yet flown at night. I think it wasn't until 1910 in South America that a plane actually flew at night. But no one knew that at the time. They thought it was some secret inventor who was about to reveal it and make his fortune, because there was a fortune to be made with aircraft. The Wright brothers sold this little stick and fabric plane to the Army for $35,000.
So what a huge amount of money then.
Huge. What would somebody who could develop something that could hover and fly quickly at night, he would have made, I don't know, hundreds of thousands, millions.
Absolutely. So there were the airships, there were dirigibles. Did any of that was, I'm just trying to think when they were around then, toward the beginning of the century.
Right. Yes, I did my dirigible research as well. And, of course, the Zeppelins in Germany could stay for 31 hours. They could stay in the air. But there were no Zeppelins in the U.S. in 1909. And the U.S. Army had something called the SC-1, which was really embarrassing. It was like a big balloon with a framework that people sat in hanging below the balloon. It could only go 20 miles an hour top speed and could only stay in the air for 2 hours. And that was our state-of-the-art dirigible. So clearly, 4 hours and something going at very fast speed does not describe any of the characteristics of anything that of the technology we had at the time.
Now, when they were witnessing this, were you able to come up with a number of witnesses approximately?
Well, I would say hundreds in the Hudson Valley, but when it moved up into New England, especially the Worcester sighting, I would have to say that had to be in the thousands. And also, I would say it had to have been in the thousands when it was being seen over New York City as well. So, it wasn't saying how many people were out, but just the scope of the, given the population densities in these area and the scope of the activity over, we're talking July to December at least, that's a lot of people.
Mm. Mm. And so where did it progress from there? You said this was the first part of the 1900s.
In 1909.
And if we could kind of go in order of the sightings. I mean, everyone always talks about, you know, no sightings ever happened before Roswell. And there's clearly something going on here. You know, there's talk about, I think they're called ghost ships. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all different types of things people were seeing. But so go ahead and continue on, if you would, with what was happening after the 1909 time period.
Just a couple of days ago, I found another article from Kingston, New York, which is in the Hudson Valley, that talked about a very large object that looked like a box kite. That's how they described it. So it was rectangular, that hung in the air motionless for hours, which that was the only, was a short description. No one had any idea what it was. And again, what did we have in 1912 that looked like a huge box that could sit motionless in the air for hours? There are some World War One era things, but of course, then we are getting into aviation. So those, you know, those are a little harder to say that they were something other. But then in the 1920s, Bud Hopkins actually worked on a case interviewing a woman who had classic abduction phenomenon. She was outside playing. She saw this bright, shiny craft. She said it was like she was rooted to the spot. Time stopped. Everything froze. And she saw these small beings. And then she kind of lost track of time, and they took off. She gets home, and her mother is scolding her. Why had she been gone so long? And to her, it had only been minutes. And she developed phobias after that about going to the doctor or getting sick or getting examined. And so, you know, everything we kind of describe as the classic abduction case and the post-abduction trauma seemed already to be present with this woman in the 1920s.
Mm. Wow. Hey, did you ever meet Bud?
No, unfortunately, I didn't have the pleasure.
Yeah. Yeah, someone was asking that on our message board. Okay, so moving along. So that was the 1920s. I mean, does this make sense to talk about this as time goes on, or would you like to?
No, that's fine, because I also interviewed a woman in her 80s who started having her abduction experiences in 1937. And this is a very bizarre case. She started seeing these short, very white figures with large eyes. And both her and her future husband, who was also having these experiences, they lived in the same apartment building as children, and they were both experiencing things then. They go on to get married in the 50s, have children who start having abduction experiences. The grandchildren are now also having them. It's quite a chilling, eye-opening case that goes all the way back to the 1930s, again, way before Roswell. No one was talking about short figures with huge eyes, you know, abducting you that I know of so much in the 30s.
No. Not really at all.
No.
Yeah. That is something it would be amazing if someone could, you know, continue, like, you know, Kathleen Martin is doing research, and there are a lot of other people doing research with abductees that, and I know Bud did an amazing job, and other people as well. But I'm just wondering if the commonalities of that time were the same as they are now.
As far as I know, there was, you know, the classic missing time, mm-hmm. you know, the description of the figures as well. The multi-generational, which I'm finding a lot in the Hudson Valley, it all seemed to, all the elements seemed to be there. She didn't describe physical effects so much, but it's a very early start, and I have to add, it is still going on this past year. She saw these figures once again. So we're talking from 1937, I don't know if anybody has a calculator, to 2015. What span of time is that? That's quite a long time.
Yeah. I can never, ever do math under pressure. I consider this pressure. So, but anyway... was she actually seeing a white figure with big eyes as well?
Two short white. She's very, very white, biggish heads, huge eyes, and they're the same ones she saw in the 40s, in the 50s, the 60s, all the way up to the present. And now, her husband was seeing them as well.
Now, a question on the message board. When did she – this is kind of key to this whole thing, I think. It makes sense to be – is when did she start telling the story?
Well, I don't know how many people – she didn't really talk too much about. She told her father in the 30s, and he just told her she was dreaming. I guess she was discussing it in the 50s a lot when her whole family was starting to have experiences. So I would love to be able to say she documented it in the 30s and 40s, but I can only take her word for it that, it really occurred.
Yeah, you know, you just have to look at it from how someone trying to debunk it, you always have to kind of approach things. Well, what will someone say? And they'll say, oh, yeah, they heard Bud Hopkins talking about interviewing people about this, and that's why, you know, she started, she wanted to, you know what I mean? You always have to,
right?
You always have to think of, and if you could find a documented case where someone actually documented it, you know, way before, say, the Betty Hill case, mm-hmm. All the better for that. And
right. The other thing is she didn't talk to newspapers or try to gain from that. She never publicly came out with this, never tried to profit from it. I think I was the first one outside the family that she had ever discussed this with.
Wow. And how did you gain her trust?
Well, I had first interviewed her son, and that was why I decided to start writing about these cases, because someone came up to me after a lecture and started telling me about it was her boyfriend's experiences. And it turned out that my husband knew this man back in high school. And I said, tell me about this guy. Is he, you know, did he make things up? And he says, I never heard of these, you know, I had no idea he'd been having these experiences. So I spoke to him and I said, okay, this guy, he has a compelling story to tell, and he has the physical marks on his body to go along with it. And when he mentioned his mother was still alive, I didn't know she was having her own experiences. I just wanted to speak to her to see what kind of boy he had been. Was he very imaginative? Was he secretive? And then as I'm speaking to her, she comes out with talking about her own experiences going back to the 30s, and what's that expression, knock me over with a feather. I had no idea, and then come to find that the grandchildren One of them's moved up to Vermont, and she and actually her child, so we're talking four generations now, are having experiences.
Now, when you were speaking to her, pardon me, I was distracted just for a second there. Did you say that it stopped at a certain time in her life?
No, it is still going on, and it has occurred again. She has seen these figures within the last year.
I'm talking about the elderly woman.
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Her too? Wow.
Yes.
That's pretty amazing.
It's, yes. It's, it is quite remarkable. And, you know, the fact that whatever this is still going on. I've got my calculator here. Let's see how many years. 78 years this has been going on with her.
That was right on the tip of my tongue.
I know.
Yeah.
I'm just confirming what you were about to say.
That's right. Yeah. So, you know, the abductions are always fascinating and kind of puzzling, and you know, there's a lot of controversy about them. Mm-hmm. Did you study both or research both abductions and the sightings at the same time?
They went hand in hand. I honestly did not expect to come across any cases like that, or you know, maybe one or two vague descriptions. And I would a very large percentage of the cases turned out to be missing time, contactees, abductees. And I'm saying to myself, what is going on here? I had no idea. You know, of course, the book Communion, Whitley Strieber's book, was based on experiences he had in the Hudson Valley. But if true, I thought that was an isolated thing to him. But I'm finding that many, many cases up and down the Hudson Valley for generations have had this very close contact. And it surprised the hell out of me, honestly. And it turned out that in the book In the Night Sky, the abduction chapter turned out to be the largest chapter in the book.
Hmm. Now, why would you speculate the Hudson Valley?
I think it's been going on a very long time, so I think we can rule out the nuclear power plant we have in the Air Force Base, and you know, it was all predating that. The only thing I can think of is a lot of the sightings take place in and around water, and of course we have the Hudson River and, mm-hmm. and many, many lakes and reservoirs, and also specifically during the Triangle sightings, a lot of them were seen in an area of the Hudson Valley that had old iron mines, minerals, and not just regular iron, but very pure, high concentrations of magnetite. Hmm. So whether or not there's something about the Earth's natural electromagnetic field in these areas that they can somehow utilize. Obviously, pure science fiction and speculation on my part, but mm-hmm. why otherwise they have been drawn here, I don't know.
That's something. Now, let's see, we have a question up there. Someone wanted to know if aliens or whoever they were communicating with this elderly lady who had contact most of her life. Were they communicating anything with her?
She doesn't really recall any kind of communication that they were ever actually speaking with her or giving her messages. However, her son said that when he was very little and they started coming in his room, he said he would see these projections. They almost sound like holographic images in his room. He said he'd see formulas and geometric shapes, and you know, he didn't quite know what it all meant, but it did seem as though they were somehow trying to communicate or teach him something. But other than that, it wasn't any clear messages that they were getting.
Now, do you happen to know in this particular family, were there any daylight abductions, or was this always when they were, like, during sleeping hours?
Oh, broad daylight in the 1940s, early 1940s. She was walking home from a friend's house, and the next thing she knew, it was hours later. And it was, you know, a sunny afternoon. Other daylight occurrences had happened to several of them. For the most part, I think a lot of them happened at night, but not all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems to me that if this was happening to me, as crazy as it would sound, I would think I would end up at a police department saying, "You guys got to help me." You know, you never hear about anyone like contacting the police and saying, "This is happening to me. I need help." Have you?
Well,
you've heard of something.
No, not really, because, I mean, you get ridiculed if you say you see a light in the sky. They would probably have locked you up if you, you know, went in and said that aliens just abducted you. For the most part, what the people I've interviewed, they've maybe told a few family members and very close friends, and that's it. There's a stigma, obviously, attached to it, and most people, they don't want to go there. They don't want to make it any worse for themselves.
Mm-hmm. I can understand that. I guess you're kind of, like, baffled by the whole thing. You know, I mean, that's what everybody kind of seems to say. Like, it's sort of almost like a dream, but not, you know. I mean, you hear that type of thing all the time.
Right, right. Either they don't remember anything, or it just seems like a dream. I am baffled, but, you know, from my chemist perspective, the story that this family has told me seems like one big science project. This is the way you would set up an experiment following generations of a family.
Absolutely. I've wondered about that. You know, you hear about the generations, and why would they be doing that? You know, maybe it is some type of experiment. What type of markings? Did you say there were markings?
Yes. On the son that I first interviewed, he has three triangular indentations on the back of his neck. He had a cauterized scoop mark that left a scar on his thigh.
You hear about the scoop marks.
Yes.
Hmm.
Yeah, he had a couple of hours. He'd seen an egg-shaped lighted craft, and the next thing he knew, it was 2 hours later. And the next day, he was having nosebleeds, and his thigh hurt, and he found this scoop mark. But he said it wasn't bleeding. It had actually been cauterized, but he could put his finger into the indentation. And he was very sick for like a week afterwards. His children, one morning, he went to kiss them goodbye as they were in bed. He used to leave for work very early. And all three of his children were in bed with blood on the pillow and blood all over their face. All three of them had nosebleeds that night.
Oh.
What are the chances?
Right. Wow. A question up on the message board. The son who had seen the holographic equations, does he now have any enhanced abilities like math or anything like that? Are you aware of that?
Not mathematically. I asked him that. Musically, he's been a musician his whole life. Mm-hmm. Whether that had anything to do with it, I don't know. Maybe they were trying to get him into math. It's all so bizarre. You try to make you're trying to make a rational picture out of something that you only have a handful of pieces for.
Right. Well, that's an amazing family story right there.
It is. It's one of many in the Hudson Valley.
Uh-huh. Do you want to talk about more? Or would you like to go chronologically forward from that time?
It's up to you. I certainly have more cases on that. Chronologically, we started just briefly in the 50s, the cigar-shaped, the saucer-shaped, moved into the triangles in the 80s. More recently, we're seeing rectangles. So lots of sightings in the 50s, 60s, 70s, an enormous amount in the 80s and 90s. Not so much in the last decade, but it does seem to be picking up. So that's kind of the chronology of it. But throughout all of that, the abductions seem to continue. A story I told at the conference, which was rather chilling, was a little girl was playing in her sandbox, and this was in the early 70s, and she looks up at the window where her mother was washing dishes or working in the kitchen. She said all of a sudden her mother was not moving, like frozen in place, and the birds stopped singing, and that whole frozen in time experience. And the next thing she knows, she's on some sort of examination table, and there's some sort of beings there, and she didn't see them speak, but in her head, she heard, "We can't keep her. We have to send her back. She's damaged." And the next thing she knows, she's back in the sandbox, and her mother's moving again, and the birds are singing again, and everything is okay. And she didn't know at the time, didn't learn until later on when she was older, that as a baby, she had something wrong, that she needed to have a stent, a drain, placed in her head, in her brain. So perhaps in that regard, she was damaged and not useful for whatever it is they were trying to do. And that certainly gave me the goosebumps hearing her story.
Yes, I remember you saying that. Yeah, that was something else.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you said back in the 50s, 1952 was a banner year. Was there a lot of sightings in the Hudson Valley during that year, are you aware of?
Not aware of 52 specifically. I know of quite a few in 53 of cigar-shaped objects. A lot of the classic saucer, flying saucer-shaped, round disc-shaped objects were in the 50s as well. And a lot of people who reported them were not reporting them because they thought they were aliens. They were reporting them because they were afraid they were Russians, Russian bombs or Russian spy planes. So there was that Cold War paranoia that obviously had people out and watching and reporting objects then.
Right, right. It's kind of funny how, the crafts seem to evolve that people see. The cigar shape, the
right
saucer, the triangle.
And as I said, we seem to be graduating now into the rectangle. Why that is, I couldn't tell you, but there does seem to be a change in craft.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier that someone mentioned something about a box shape.
Yes, as I said, just a couple of days ago when I was researching newspaper files, I came upon, they described it as looking like a giant box kite. So my interpretation of that, it was, rectangular or box-shaped, and they described it as very large and absolutely motionless for hours in the sky.
Hmm.
So if it was some sort of dirigible, obviously they're not box-shaped, and they cannot remain motionless if there's any kind of wind. obviously. So I'm going to search more around that time period and see if I can find any other accounts of this.
Now, is it microfilm? Is that what you search through?
When I go to the historical societies, I search microfilm. Otherwise, there are some online newspaper archives that I search as well. Mm-hmm. But it's difficult because they weren't using the term UFO, in the early years. So I try to do search for strange lights or, object in the sky. So you're fishing, you're throwing out all these terms and seeing if you get a hit on something.
Right. Boy, so many different terms, right?
Yes. Yes. You're and if right. anybody out there has some other suggestions, I'm open to it. Otherwise, you just sit there and go through newspaper after newspaper. And it's very time consuming.
Now, we have about 3 minutes left to the top of the hour. What would you say for the earlier sightings before, 1947, when you heard everything about, the flying saucers after that? Mm-hmm. What would you say was the most profound sighting that was on record?
Well, I have to say this mysterious airship of 1909 was, today would be considered a major flap. I mean, mass sightings throughout the East Coast over the course of at least 6 months. I'm very impressed by the characteristics of, what people were describing, the flight characteristics. And as I say, just the sheer number of people over such a long period of time, it really is remarkable and really deserves to have further study.
Mm-hmm. Now, someone mentioned on the message board a while back, did you see if any of these were related to Pennsylvania as well?
I hadn't seen any accounts mentioning Pennsylvania, but then again, I have not been searching Pennsylvania newspapers.
Right.
Mostly New York, New England. And it really was as far north as Rochester, which is, way to the north of the state, and out to the coast, Boston, up to Maine, down to New York City. So Pennsylvania certainly could have been included in that. It's a good idea to because I know Connecticut was included in that as well. So I should check actually New Jersey and Pennsylvania.
Yeah, there wasn't really any network of newspaper that branched out between states really to speak of. So you really have, when you're doing research in the olden times, you have to go region by region, really, don't you?
Yes, you do. And if you're lucky enough to do it online and get a hit, though actually I found one account, it was mentioned in a Kansas City newspaper. They would somehow take little bits from around the country. So you really have to do a shotgun approach and check them all. But obviously your best bet is your regional papers.
Yes. Okay. So we're ready to say goodbye to our first hour guests. So say goodbye to them.
Goodbye.
And we'll be back in hour two. If you'd like to support the show, we'll be back in hour two. And we're going to be talking about the triangle UFOs. And we're also going to be talking about Pine Bush and a lot more. So if you're listening live, hang in for right after the music break. We'll be right back. Okay, my guest is Linda Zimmerman, and we're back. If you're listening live and you're in the chat room, you're in Dark Matter Radio, you can jump over to the chat room at Podcast UFO and ask our guests some questions. So, Linda, going back to Pine Bush, that's what we've never talked about. When did all that start?
The earliest accounts that we seem to be able to, can't exactly pinpoint, but we can push it back to the 1920s. But the most, yes. But the real documented sightings, really the 50s and into the 60s. And then it really took off late earlys and early 90s. That was the, I guess we can call it the golden era of the Pine Bush sightings, when hundreds of people from the tri-state area would line the streets of this little farm community every single night because they were visible every single night.
Right. One of the people that supports the show in the chat room right now, I know, lived in that area, I believe, and mentioned there was a lot of things going on. And you're saying that how many, any estimation of the amount of witnesses?
Oh, again, it has to be thousands, because you could get hundreds of people on a Tuesday night, you know, in the middle of winter. I mean, it was in its heyday. People, one of the men who I have dealt with, he runs a Pine Bush archive. He's trying to collect every account of every sighting ever in Pine Bush. And he would drive, he would work all day. He would drive an hour and 45 minutes in the middle of the week up to Pine Bush, spend hours there with his friend, drive home in the wee hours and do it again. There was that kind of dedication. And this went on for years. So you could have hundreds of people on any given night, 7 days a week, month after month. So, you know, we don't want to do the, we don't want to put ourselves on the spot doing the math, but, you add that with all of the residents over the years. And again, thousands and thousands of people saw these.
Now that's, I was just looking online. That's a very small area, really.
It really is. And back then, it was mostly farms, a little town center. And one of the things that helped bring the viewers to a demise, everybody lining the streets, was development was coming to Pine Bush in the late 80s. And the developers were not happy that where they wanted to put houses, you had 100, you know, crazy UFO people camped out in their lawn chairs all night long. Really, who's going to buy a house, you know, when every night it's a UFO watching party? So they actually were sabotaging. They were throwing tacks down on the side of the road where the people were parking so they'd all get flat tires.
Oh, that's nice.
They were having confrontations with the people. And they finally got the town to pass an ordinance to make sky watching illegal.
Oh, my goodness.
So if you were standing outside in Pine Bush at night looking up at the sky, you could be ticketed for that.
Are you kidding me?
No, I kid you not. That was how extreme it got with the UFO community and the developers. Of course, the developers won. They had the money. They were bringing the development to town. And, you know, people would still find their spots and dodge the police. And,
That sounds unconstitutional almost.
I would think so in a big way. Who can tell you you can't stand outside, you can't look up at night? I mean, it's just absolutely ridiculous. But the worm has turned completely. Now Pine Bush embraces its UFO heritage. They call themselves the UFO capital of the Northeast, and every year they have a huge festival, Pine Bush UFO Festival, and it's May 16th this year, and they have a street fair and a parade, and I'll be there giving a lecture, and there'll be other lectures. So once they realize the economic advantages of having a lot of people come to town, it changed. And we went from illegal to Skywatch to now they have an official town viewing site, which is wonderful. And I don't know how many towns in the country have an official UFO viewing site.
Not too many.
No.
Yeah, there was some type of politician that was trying to put a landing site in somewhere, and he basically got bumped and laughed out of office, I guess.
Yeah, it's not the best thing for your career, unfortunately, to promote such things. But I think it's very smart of Pine Bush to do it, because it certainly brings people into town, and there is a legitimate legitimate activity that is still going on there today. Within the last year or so, giant rectangles are being seen, smaller triangles. And one of the bizarre things about Pine Bush that the man who runs the Pine Bush Archive often mentions is a lot of the activity is ground-based. Lights coming up out of the ground.
Really?
Lights hovering around the ground, people hearing noises and feeling vibrations underground, huge craft just seeming to rise up out of the woods. When we were doing one of our stakeouts, UFO stakeouts, we call it a couple, just last year, we're overlooking this field and suddenly it was like a giant flashbulb went off in the woods, and it was so bright it lit everybody up. No sound, and it was localized to about 50 yards from where we were standing. And we took off running, and we searched everywhere, and there was nothing. And when I got home, I said, well, you know, people are going to say it was some sort of lightning, and the nearest thunderstorm was 80 miles away that night. I don't understand the ground-based phenomenon, but many people have witnessed and photographed lights, at ground level.
Wow, that is quite amazing. A person that lived there back in the 90s is on our message board and was saying that there was a science study that was done there with black boxes for hearing noises or something.
Mm-hmm.
She says that they were there for 24 hours, and I may be mixing up two different posts here, and that they would gather together and watch the sky. It was on a deserted road that everyone knew about, and they would all spend the night on that road in their cars around the woods.
Yeah, Searsville Road was one of them. There was a couple of everybody seemed to have their favorite spots, but they were all in the general same area.
And I'm going to have her elaborate on another thing she posted. So you say that's ongoing, and started around the 1920s. Can you fill in the gaps and what has been going on all that time there?
I need to back up a little and expand, because it was the early 80s that the massive silent triangle started showing up in great number in the Hudson Valley. And that, if anybody has heard of the Hudson Valley, it's probably because, you know, in terms of UFOs, it's probably the early 80s, mid 80s, when things the size of a football field or a couple of football fields would hover silently at treetop level, at least 25,000 people over the course of those years saw it. And I think that is really conservative, because you could have had 5,000 in one night. People would just stop their cars in the middle of highways, wherever they were, and watch these objects. And it seems that when those started to diminish in number was when the pine bush activity took over. Some massive triangles, but a lot of them were smaller. Smaller triangles, or they would just see lights. The man who runs the Pine Bush Archives, he has a remarkable description where he said it almost looked like a Ferris wheel of lights rotating up out of the woods. Just things that absolutely boggled people's minds, or something very simple like, you know, like maybe an amber-colored light just darting around the fields and through the woods. So that really picked up in the late 80s and early 90s. So that, as I said, kind of the golden era for Hudson Valley UFO sightings, which all culminated in Pine Bush.
Wow. I believe there was a video up on YouTube that was kind of similar to what you were talking about, like a spinning lights that go around in a circle. That was supposed to be Pine Bush. Are you familiar with that? I may be confusing that.
I don't know. I can't tie that. I've seen a lot of videos, but I don't recall that one specifically.
I see. I'm trying to get the person on the chat room to call in.
Okay.
But yeah, this is really fascinating. So what are, before we leave Pine Bush, I want to talk more about that, because it's such a curious thing that such a small place could have so much going on. And besides the viewing area that they set up, are people still going on these same roads and stopping at night and looking?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, the Pine Bush Festival brings them in and makes them aware of it. When I'm speaking with people, you know, giving lectures or doing book signings, you know, everybody says, well, where can I go to experience them? And I'm still sending them to Pine Bush, because I think that's still their best shot at seeing something unusual. You don't have hundreds lining the streets anymore, but I'll tell you, a couple of intense sightings, and I think very quickly they'll all be back.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And do people? The person is probably going to be calling in any second here. I think she is now. Hang on just a second. All right, I'm going to join her to the call.
Anymore.
Hello there.
Hello there.
Hi, Peggy.
Oh, yes, here. Yeah.
Peggy, you're on with Linda and myself, of course.
Oh, am I on?
You are on right now, live.
Yes, hello, Peggy.
Hello, Linda. I am loving listening to you. You're fabulous.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
Really, really interesting. And boy, when you started talking about Pine Bush, I got my juices going.
Well, I'd love to hear your story.
Well, we lived in New Jersey in the 90s, and of course, I've been into UFOs forever, and we watched some program, sightings, I think it was, and found out about Pine Bush, and it was about 2 hours from us. In total, we made 3 or 4 trips up there, and always had something interesting happen. And it was supposedly at this field that was known to be where the emanations from the grounds took place.
Was that, you know, Strawberry what I'm talking about? Field?
Yes.
Yes.
In those days, there was like one house on the road.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a big empty field. But the people up there, that was half the fun of going. You know, some just curious like we were. And then we would run into, say, the teaching assistants from Princeton, who had heard about it and were up there trying to do a scientific study on it. I don't know whatever came of it, but it
right.
was really interesting.
It was quite a melting pot. I was up there too.
I know, we probably were there at the same time.
Probably.
Yeah, we saw some really amazing things in the sky one night. We saw pulsating lights. Another night, this has always haunted me. We were all standing around a large evergreen tree. It must have been 50 feet high. And it started, and it was a windless night, but all of a sudden that tree started shaking, and it shook from the bottom, and not a huge shaking, but it was like the whole thing started to tinkle. Huh. And it tinkled from the bottom up to the top, and then there was a whooshing noise, like a blast of hot air.
The blast of hot air.
We all felt the blast of hot air. Yeah. I don't know if that was the same night that my daughter, it was, and she's here. She can tell you what she saw. Do you want that, Martin?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because it's better coming from the person who saw it. I might mess it, but anyway, yeah, great stories there. Hold on a second. This is Brooke.
Hello?
Hey, Brooke, how are you?
I'm good. Hi, Martin.
Okay, hello. We want to hear this. You're on with Linda Zimmerman.
Hello, Linda.
Hi, Brooke.
Sorry, I was just eating a peanut butter sandwich. My mom called me. I was about 17, and it was pitch black, and there was just light, like, from the moon and stars. And on the road off to the right of it was, like, this parking area. It was, like, a gravel lot with some logs laid down. It was kind of like an informal area to stop. And there were, like, 10 people there. The Princeton researchers were there that night. And they were all sitting with their backs to the woods. And I was standing in front of them, looking behind them. And there was a big bush behind them. And I saw fingers, like long fingers. And the top part of what I now know is a gray, eyes and head peek over at us. I was terrified when I saw that. So, of course, I was like, I was pointing, I was like, there's something back there, there's something back there. I saw a face, you know. And the prison researchers, of course, jumped up and ran to try to go behind it. And you could hear whatever it was fleeing through the woods. They were so thick, though, we couldn't follow them. And it was after that that when we were walking down the road, when my mother described the tree with the hot blast of air. It was a cool night. Like, I had a comforter wrapped around me, even though it was the summertime. But I'll never forget seeing that face and the sound of it running from
us.
Wow. Yeah. I would say it was life-changing. I mean, you know, I was like 17. I'd watch sightings, but, you know, I just thought it was kind of fun to go out in the dark and look around. You know, I didn't know what to think. And after that, I was like, oh, okay, this is real.
Did you happen to see how many digits were on the fingers?
I only saw two.
Hand, I mean.
I only saw two.
Huh. Wow.
Wow.
Interesting story.
Yeah, I would love for you you and your mom to get in touch with me. You know, I would like to include this in the Pine Bush Archives, if not, you know, a future book, if you would get in touch with me through my website.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, I can arrange all that. No problem.
Okay, great. Please. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Brooke.
Sure. Thanks for listening.
Okay.
Do you want to talk to my mom or hanging up? Hanging up. Okay, sorry. Okay. Thanks. Bye.
All right, bye now.
Yeah, in fact, that's fascinating. Somebody at the conference out in Arizona just told me a story that somebody who lived in Pine Bush told some friends of his, come up to Pine Bush one night, and this was back in 2004, and just look up at the sky. He wouldn't say why, and they came up, and I guess they saw a triangular craft, and so they reported to him, this is what we saw. And they said, you know, why did you have us come up? Because he claimed that one night he heard something and I guess went out into his yard, and there was a gray standing in the neighbor's yard looking at him. And he described a very foul odor that accompanied it. And So grays are popping up in Pine Bush as well.
It's funny you hear, I'm really going way off topic on this one. But you always hear about the foul odor when people say they see Bigfoot, too.
Yeah, good point. And, you know, some people speculate that they might be alien.
Yeah, there's some type of connection. People are speculating that. All interesting things. Wow. So let's talk now about that you keep bringing up triangles. It seems like that's mostly what people are seeing today, or what's going on with that?
Today, the more recent ones are smaller triangles, not the football field size. But I did mention the rectangles, which are enormous. We did have a sighting, a mass sighting in the Hudson Valley about a year and a half ago of a cylinder. It was described as like a telephone pole covered in an aluminum foil. It was a very, very windy day, yet this object remained motionless in the sky. One professional aerial photographer used his HD camera equipment to film this object. It didn't move for 2 hours. And he was calling, you know, the FAA and air traffic control because, you know, there's a lot of airports in the New York area and nobody seemed to be interested. And people saw it up and down the Hudson Valley that day.
That is quite amazing. It's I know someone I was talking to that said their neighbors and everyone they could find watched this thing that looked like a washing machine just floating above, like 200 or 300 feet above a house for hours and hours. It was like 4 hours.
Wow.
And they couldn't get anyone, not even the police, to come out and take a look.
It just astounds me. But, you know, so many people I've spoken to, you know, they said they called the police and were accused of being drunk or crazy or, you know, committing a prank. And very few people have ever been taken seriously when they try to report it.
Yeah. Well, that's what my own personal experience was, actually.
Oh, so you did try reporting?
Well, I tried reporting to a police department. And, you know, the woman was very sarcastic and put me on hold for about 15 minutes. It probably was less, but it seemed like at least that.
Right.
So I finally hung up.
Yeah, that's just it. And then, you know, somebody asked me at the conference about police reports because, you know, the nights of the mass sightings in the 80s, you know, thousands of people called, yet I have not been able to recover one single report from any police department or sheriff's office. They all, you know, they claim we don't have any records. Nobody ever called us. And it's just a farce. It's, you know, I don't know why I waste my breath sometimes trying to get this information.
I would think that with all those sightings that the police would be very heavily involved. You know, it seems like they couldn't not be.
They should have been because entire police departments were witnessing these at the same time. Many of the sightings began with, you know, officers on patrol seeing these things and radioing to other people in, you know, in their department. And cops were standing shoulder to shoulder with everyone else out there watching them. And yet, where were the police reports? I don't know. One sighting that occurred on, I believe it was in the 1976, a mass sighting on over a bridge. You know, hundreds, if not thousands, of people saw this diamond-shaped object, and they tried to report it to the state police, and he said, yeah, don't even bother. Because the police, the state policeman, had a very intense sighting of an object following his patrol car as he was driving along, and he tried to report it. They told him, "Don't say a word," you know, at his headquarters, and he tried to get it in the newspaper, and he was told, you know, "Don't you dare." So you know, so he told these people, if I can't get something reported or in the newspaper, you know, what chance do you have?
Right. Maybe that's why the other cop ran from.
Now, could be.
Going back, you mentioned earlier that there's a lot of airports in the area. Has someone come up with some type of logic that some of the lights that people are seeing are from, you know, the planes coming in at night, stuff like that?
Yeah, that's one of the things when we do our pine bush stakeouts that within 15, 20 minutes, you can easily identify the aircraft routes. It used to be Stewart Air Force Base. It's now a National Guard base and an international airport. A lot of commercial traffic coming in and out is not, I'd say, 15 miles from there. But a good pair of binoculars and just listening, you identify the aircraft routes very, very simply, you know, and then going to the major New York airports like JFK and LaGuardia. So once you identify those, and of course, if you see something with completely different flight characteristics, you know, then you know. But when their planes are I can see where people get confused, because when the planes are approaching for a landing, this giant spotlight seems to come beaming down.
Mm-hmm.
And if, you know, you have the radio on and you don't hear the sound of the plane, or you just glance, you can easily think it's a UFO.
Right. Speaking of airports, what about radars?
Well, one of the best radar contact cases I haven't written about yet. I have it for my next book, but I can share it with you. That woman was over by White Plains Airport, and that's on the east side of the river. And she was a plane spotter by profession. I didn't realize they had such things. She worked for LaGuardia, and she would identify aircraft and read their tail numbers so they could cross-check, make sure apparently drug runners would steal a plane and change the tail number. Yeah. So that was her job. She could identify aircraft from miles out. Well, she sees this massive object near her home in Westchester. Clearly not any aircraft she has ever experienced. And she was working at the local airport there, White Plains, at the time. She calls the guy she knew who does the radar in the tower, and he says, "Oh, yeah, we've got this thing on radar. It's huge." He's freaking out because he's has no idea what it is he's seeing on the radar contact. And she and many other people watched this huge object slowly moving through airspace. Next day, she goes to go to work at the airport, and this radar guy is running around the parking lot like a crazy person looking for it. He sees her car, goes running over to it, and as soon as she gets out of the car, she's like, "What's the matter?" "Don't say anything. Don't say a word. It was a flock of birds." He's like, "What are you talking about?" Well, after he got off the phone with her, there apparently had been a little Air Force group that had part of the airport. They come busting through the control tower door, guns drawn.
Oh, my goodness.
And tell everybody in there, if they want to keep their jobs, they just witnessed a flock of birds. And made some other veiled threats about what else could happen. They went to the supervisors and said the same thing. So when she got into work, the supervisor immediately called her in and said, "I don't know what you saw. I don't want to know, but it was a flock of birds." And she starts to protest. He said, "We're all going to lose our jobs, or worse, if you say it was anything else."
Wow.
And So they had the radar contacts. They had multiple eyewitnesses, you know, a trained plane spotter seeing this. And what gives the Air Force the right to bust in on a civilian facility with their guns drawn and intimidate them like that?
That is amazing. What year did that happen?
I'm trying to recall off. I think this was early 80s.
Isn't that something?
Wow. Yes.
I've never heard of anything quite like that.
No, I was stunned, you know, at both the quality of the witnesses, the radar, everything, and the incredible intimidation factor. And I even said to her, should you be saying this today? She says, you know, what are they going to do to me now, is basically what she was saying.
Can she get anyone to corroborate her story?
I asked her about the radar guy, and she, no pun intended, lost contact with him. And she doesn't know where he is to this day.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So if anybody out there had a similar experience, you know, I'm hoping once I put it in the book and start talking about it, that hopefully other witnesses will come forth, and maybe we can even find this man.
Yeah. Yeah. Not that long ago. I mean,
no.
Right. Wow. That is totally an amazing story. Are there any other radar stories, contact stories that you're aware of?
Yes. As a matter of fact, it's not a triangle sighting, but Stewart Air Force Base used to have a facility called SAGE. And SAGE was a part of this massive radar installation, the Strategic Air Defense, and there were SAGE buildings across the country, which was state-of-the-art radar. And I was told by a member of the Air Force who worked in that facility, I believe it was 1968, I want to say, that SAGE facility after SAGE facility up the East Coast had radar contact with an incredibly fast object moving low, you know, where aircraft travel. This wasn't high in the atmosphere. It raced up the East Coast at such a blinding speed. It threw everybody into, you know, great excitement and chaos. I don't know if they even had time to respond with airplanes or anything. It was moving that fast. But he said immediately they knew it wasn't us. It wasn't the Russians. It wasn't from anywhere on this planet. And he said for years afterwards, they would talk about that night, because that was the night they all knew we weren't alone.
Wow. Has there been any physical trace, you know, like trace evidence that you're aware of? Like landing trace or anything like that?
Oh, yes. One of my favorite cases, I was actually interviewing a couple in Monroe, New York, who had a few sightings of circular craft, and they happened to have a neighbor stop by as I was interviewing them. And I said, you know, did you ever see these craft? Because she had lived there for many decades. And she said, yeah, one night they were, she and her husband were in bed. He was asleep. And she said suddenly her bedroom lit up like like Mack truck headlights were pointed in there. And normally she was extremely skittish and about being robbed and, you know, would jump up at the slightest provocation. But for some reason, she just, it like lulled her to sleep. She's like, oh, I'll find out what it was in the morning. Yeah. She said, completely uncharacteristic of her. Morning comes, she wakes up her husband, she tells him about these bright lights, and he's like, yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, he was a science teacher, and it's like, prove it. Mm-hmm. So he goes outside, He comes running back in, white as a sheet, you know, call the sheriff, call the police, call everybody, you know, calm down, what happened? Well, they had been doing construction, and they had a truckload of sand delivered. So they had this small mountain of sand in their driveway. He went outside. All that was left, the whole sand pile was gone, whether it was taken or looked like it was blown away. There were concentric rings of sand that were melted and pressed into the blacktop. And that was all that was left. The entire pile was gone. So something about 18 feet in diameter that was very heavy and very hot blew away that pile of sand and left that sand melted and embedded, as I said, in concentric rings in their driveway.
Wow. Did anyone think to do any scientific testing?
Fortunately, they took a couple of Polaroid photos, but they couldn't get anyone to come by. He called the state police, and he said that they had so many reports of circular craft that night, they weren't even going to bother following up. They couldn't possibly follow up. But he, you know, he's explaining they had these rings in their driveway, and no one ever came out. So the driveway is still there. It has been covered over with another layer of blacktop. This was back in 1982. But she said, if I can get a scientific team out there to somehow remove that top layer, we are more than welcome to. I'm planning, once the snow melts, to bring my Geiger counter over there to at least see if there's any residual radioactivity. But I would love to have somebody see if they can uncover that layer, you know, dig it up, preserve it for posterity, run tests on it. So it's still there.
Wow, interesting. By the way, the snow is never going to melt this year.
I suspected as much, but I didn't want to say it.
Yeah, I'm totally convinced. I'm looking out at over 4 feet right outside the window here.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, core sample, someone just said. On the message board. That would be the thing to do with something like that.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I would love to be able to, though, to peel back that layer and, you know, preserve that whole 18-foot section of those concentric rings, but at least they thought to take a series of Polaroids.
You know, it seems to me with all the activity going on in that general area that there would just be a lot more research involved in this.
That's one of the things that was baffling to me. Even within, when I was at the UFO conference 2 years ago with the when we introduced the In the Night Sky film, I was talking to people assuming they knew about the Hudson Valley with all its sightings, and people didn't even know where the Hudson Valley was, let alone know about the number. I was stunned.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, this is like a new subject to many people, even those within the UFO community. Of course, if you lived in the Hudson Valley, you know, since the 70s, 80s, 90s, you know about it. You know, a lot of people who have recently moved in or younger people, it's also kind of new to them. But that's one of the points I'm trying to get across when I, you know, give lectures or do radio shows like this. Why isn't more attention being paid to this? This is huge. I honestly believe it's the number one hot spot in the entire country over the last 100 years.
It very well could be. And I had a very interesting guest on a while back, Doug Trumbull, and along with himself and Mark D'Antonio, they're putting together these units that are supposed to take all types of scientific readings, motion sensored, and all that, that can be networked and in different areas. And they are actually looking for, you know, areas of considered hot spots. And this is something I definitely will talk to Mark D'Antonio about your area and perhaps connect you to. Perhaps you can figure out a really good area to put some of these things.
Oh, I would love to. because in addition to Pine Bush, we had a little mini flap in a town of Warwick, which is just about 20 minutes from me, over the last year or two of small triangular craft seen just about every night over the summer. And in fact, one caught me by surprise. I was giving a lecture at the library in Warwick, and somebody comes running in and said, "There's a triangular craft over the library." And they, you know, they were serious. And I was like, okay, either this is a great coincidence or something really weird is going on here. That as I'm giving my UFO lecture, there's a triangular craft sighting right over the library.
Amazing. There's a question on the message board that he wants to go back, if it's okay with you, to the 78-year-old abductee's family. One, do you know if the abductees, the children, are RH blood type or not?
I have no idea. What is the significance
okay.
of that?
Two, her son is an apparent abductee and found his children with bloody faces. And there are other marks in the children. Do the children have recollections of the abductions?
His children don't want to talk about it at all. He mm-hmm. has tried to bring this up, and his sister will talk about, because he had two sisters that had things happen as well. His one sister won't talk about it. His other sister will. But his children, they don't even want to talk about the craft sightings, let alone any of the abduction experience.
I see. Just asking about the... Oh, it says... he says that most abductees are RH negative. I've never heard that before. Have you?
That is news to me, but I am writing that down. No, that is certainly something to look into. Any kind of pattern would be fascinating.
Yeah, I would like to know where that information came from.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and I'm sure he'll type that out in a second. Let's see, we have about 15 minutes left, and I'm wondering what direction you would like to go, and can we talk? I think everything that you've been speaking about is absolutely fascinating. I really do. It's been a really good show.
Thank you.
And I'm just trying to figure out where to go from here as far as moving along. We said that we're going to be talking about triangles. We haven't too much. So can you explain more about them, and are they all like really large, like you were speaking of earlier?
In the early 80s, around 82, 83, 83 was the banner year for the massive triangles. I'm talking things at least the size of a football field. Many, many witnesses I spoke to said they would be silently, ever so slowly moving just at treetop height. One man described it, if he was a little younger and had a baseball, he could have hit it. Another man told me he was a tennis player. He said, oh, he easily could have hit it, you know, with a tennis ball. Absolutely silent, usually brilliantly lit, would move across highways and over towns. I interviewed three teachers who were coming home from graduate school. Highway, everybody was pulled over. They pulled over. And they said this huge triangle was motionless and silent directly overhead for 20 minutes. You know, in a field where if you see something for 5 seconds, you remember it your entire life. I can't imagine the effect this had on those women standing there for 20 minutes. And this was going on for years all over the lower, particularly the lower Hudson Valley. Boomerang shapes were also seen. The one I saw, it could have been triangular, but I described it as a V shape because it seemed like only the leading edge had lights on it. it had been photographed.
I want to stop right there, if you
sure.
would. That was coming to mind about photographs. Are there a lot of photographs and videos of these sightings?
There are some videos, not too many, but there was one fantastic photograph I included in the first book, taken by a high school photography student. He's coming out of school one evening, and it was one of the nights of the mass sightings, March 24th, 1983. And he snapped a picture of this brilliantly lit triangle, which was shining a beam of light down to the ground and lighting it up. He developed it. He brought it to the police and was told it was a formation of ultralights and never pursued. You know, when you're 17 years old and the cops are telling you, basically laughing it off, you know, you don't pursue it.
Seems like they've used that one a few times, huh?
Ad nauseum. I use that term, as I say, because it makes me sick how many times it was used. To disprove, people are still using that excuse who've never even seen an ultralight. So I actually went up in an ultralight when I was doing my research to understand the flight characteristics and realize how unstable they are, how unbelievably deafeningly noisy they are. But, you know, so when people try to tell me, oh, they can discount the entire giant triangle sightings because they were ultralights, you know, now I can turn to them. Really? Have you ever been in an ultra? Have you even seen an ultralight? You know, well, I have, and it's ridiculous.
Yeah, they're noisy things that flutter all over the place.
Exactly. Exactly. So, again, it's estimated at least 25,000 people saw that. Thousands of people reported it, these sightings, and they went on for years and years.
Now, a question up on the message board. Has anyone seen any of these triangles shoot off, or are they always just kind of drifting around?
Well, that's the thing. They can, you know, people who are arguing that they were stealth blimps, you know, Air Force blimps, yes, they could hover silently, but people describe them as moving off in the blink. You know, they would say to me, it just went pew, and they would take off and be gone in the blink of an eye. So they had both the characteristics of incredibly fast, but yet being able to hover. So maybe blimps can hover, but I don't know that they can shoot off at extremely high rates of speed.
I've heard two people say that they've had a triangle go directly over them, and they both, one said she felt pressure, like she was being pushed down on the ground, and another one also said she felt some type of weird pressure. Has anyone mentioned anything like this that you're aware of?
Not the pushing down pressure. That's something I haven't heard, but I have heard they feel almost a reverberation in their body. One man described something fascinating. I've heard this a couple of times now, that the bottom almost seemed to be rippling, like liquid mercury.
Yes.
One described it. Mm-hmm. Another described it like looking at the bottom of a glass bottom boat. Yet other people said it was solid black, or it was metallic, or they could see beams or structure. But the pressure, I'm writing that down too, something to ask people.
I'm trying to think of what that James Fox movie that's so good, Out of the Blue, is that? No.
I Know What I Saw, was that?
Yeah, it was all
like
part
that?
Of the same, yeah.
Yeah.
But they were describing in the Phoenix Lights, very much like what you're talking about, like a rippling, like almost like looking through a vapor or something moving. And then other people described it as a solid object. But
right.
Again, a massive triangle.
Yeah, one of the best triangle stories I heard was from this little research librarian who back in the 80s was waiting at the bus stop for her husband, and she sees this massive triangle. She did not describe it as a football field. She said it was the size of a football stadium, and there was an opening in the center that from her angle she was able to look up into it. She said it was like the balconies on the side of an apartment building all lit up, which I thought was a fabulous... She's the only one I've interviewed who actually saw inside of it. And then she said this red light came up from behind, went up into it. She didn't see a hatch closing. She just said the opening was gone, and it took off, like, again, like, phew, just shot away.
Wow. Now, going back to what I just mentioned a few minutes ago, the Phoenix Lights, it seems like, you know, that is such a big deal, but it sounds like in your area or the Hudson Valley area, that's an ongoing thing.
Like, yeah, that's why I was kind of surprised that the Phoenix Lights got the huge publicity it did and everybody knew about it. Of course, they did have great video and a lot of witnesses, but, you know, if you grew up in the Hudson Valley and you were around during that time, it's like, yeah, we had this just about every night. So again, right. It's how is it that we have really gone under the radar for most part?
Right. Now, in all your writing of your two books and your lecturing and all that, what do you say to people that think it's totally ridiculous that we could possibly be visited by, say, aliens or whatever they are visiting us?
Well, I point out that we went from the Wright brothers to walking on the moon in a little over 60 years. And what will a civilization with another 1,000 years or 10,000 years be able to accomplish? I interviewed an astronomer for the film and the first book, and he readily admitted that life is probably everywhere in the universe. I mean, he would bet everything that life is everywhere. But when it came to anyone visiting us, absolutely not, could not happen.
Mm-hmm.
And there seems to be this stubbornness, this bias in the scientific community that if we don't understand it and can't do it, it can't be done. And, you know, I wrote a book called Bad Science where, you know, the history of science where scientists were always telling the next generation, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. You know, you're wrong. You can't do that. And it's like they don't want to admit there are things beyond their mental capacity to understand. I have no problem with that. There's probably lots of life out there far smarter than we are. And our job is to try to understand it and communicate with it, I think, and learn from it. That's what science should be all about, not denying it before you even examine the phenomena.
Yeah, I'm totally 100% right there with you. I could have been saying exactly what you just said about that, you know, the way that they can totally believe that life is out there. You know, I could give many examples. Seth Shostak, for one, totally believes life's out there, but, you know, oh my God, we're not being visited. It's impossible. We're too far away.
And yet we send probes out with records of, human speech. You know, what was that, Voyager? With the,
that's right.
The record. We're sending things out so that other alien races can find it.
Well, that's right. It's amazing that thing is still communicating with us. I can't believe it. You know that there's more computing power in a key fob that you use to open your car with than that thing had?
I believe it. Yeah, I'm a bit of a fan of the early space program. And, you know, the rockets they went on, I said they were basically tin cans with explosives under them. you know, that's about it.
Yeah. Now, do you have a website?
Yes, my main website is gotozim.com. That's gotozim.com. And if you're specifically interested in the UFOs, you can go off to the right-hand side and click on the UFO portion. You know, I write about other things. I write fiction. I write zombie novels. I'm really big into zombies. And
really? Wow.
Yeah, love that.
Everyone loves zombies today.
Yeah, yeah. So I had to have zombies invading the Hudson Valley. And lots of other topics. Yeah. So I would love to, if people have Hudson Valley stories, to please go to my website and contact me. And I'd love to hear your account.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you so much, Linda. This was this has been a real pleasure.
Oh, I loved every minute of it. Thank you for having me on and for the full 2 hours.
Well, that's it for the show. And if you're listening this long, that means you are a supporter. I want to thank you very much. And I also want to thank everyone else for helping out with the show today. Alejandra Rojas for the news. Our guest, Linda Zimmerman. She was great, wasn't she? Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse and Bruce Rainier for the music. Peggy Shunning for managing our Facebook page. And remember to like us on Facebook for all the latest UFO news. We have Tom Reed coming up next week. And you can check us out live for the full show on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Or as a podcast, being a supporter. Again, thank you. So we're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. This is Martin Willis reminding you to keep your eyes to the sky, and we'll see you.